to raise your hand and ask a question. If you could also just say your name and the organisation that you represent, and also if we can be very diligent to keep questions to actual questions and not our own reflections, well, I'm sure we're going to have an interesting comment and debate as the questions progress. So yes, question from the front as well.
That's good. Yes.
Any particular person on the panel? Mm-hmm. Is that to any particular person on the panel?
No, I was thinking, I was wondering what they...
Well, I mean, it's an issue in many countries, including the United States, but, you know, my answer to that is there are more minorities who are available to be deceased donors because of the structural violence that puts them in harm's way. Number two, they don't have... they're highly represented in the uninsured. Why should they trust when they have not been taken care of during their life and indicating that they don't want? I've sat at churches, evangelical and black and other churches, and it's not that African Americans, to take one group, are not generous. They are resentful about the poor care that they and their families have gotten. But that's the United States.
But they would benefit.
In the UK, you're quite right. A patient from the black and minority ethnic population is probably 3 to 5 times more likely to suffer an illness, as many of you know this, that would probably need, or would need a kidney transplant. And if you go around to dialysis ward in London, as I have, the majority of patients are from the BME community, you're quite right. And they do wait longer for a kidney because less donors come from those populations. So what we've been trying to do for the last few years is to understand why, and we continue to do that. And the media campaign that began today, although that's not actually targeting the BME communities as such, it's because I think some of the concerns held within the BME communities are held by everybody. You know, what's going to happen? Is the person going to be disfigured if they donate? You know, that's kind of things. Are they going to die? If they sign up in the organ donor register, are you going to let them die? Those are concerns held across all of the groups. But I mean, there are some specific concerns that we need to address. And over the last year, we've been, nationally, NHS Blood and Transplant have been going out to the various communities to try and understand that. And from January, there's going to be another campaign looking at the BME community specifically to try and raise donor rates within those communities. But we've been doing it for many years now, going out. But it's very difficult because quite often, although we know that the major religions support donation, it's when you get down to the local communities that you need to work with them, and that's very resource intensive to actually get in to work with the local communities. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to get people from the communities trained up to go back and work with, you know, with their communities then, and that's proved quite effective. But you're quite right, but it's a daily job, really. It's a big job.
Question at the back there.
I'm Tom Campbell from the Organ Donor Campaign. Is it okay if I can just follow on with that question? Kim was talking about the religious aspects to this whole thing, and in conjunction with the Organ Donor Campaign has actually been running a group of seminars and conferences on tapping each of the 6 main religions within the United Kingdom and getting together all the different spectrums of these religions and putting them together with doctors and ethicists, etc. to actually create a body of information which can then be given to the various organ donor leads and all the other articles which are required in hospitals, we target this from different aspects, and you train medical students to deliver these kind of workshops within all of these communities. And being based in Manchester, we are heavily ethnically minority orientated. And the conferences have been a great success so far for the simple reason that many of the people we've talked to have been very, very happy to receive a government initiative which is really addressing all the different strands and is making it available so that anybody can use this information, any doctor can have this information, and they can give it to people in the situation of bereavement, which is, as you know, it's very obvious, that's the situation where many people cannot speak to their issues, they don't even think about it. So, yeah, so I'm just going to follow up on
that. Thank you. Okay. Is there a question? Yeah. I'll take those two. The gentleman in the glasses at the back and the lady in the white sweater.
I'm David Napier, University College London Center for Applied Global Citizenship. I'm also a medical anthropologist. My question is a rather political one, and it's addressed to anyone on the panel, but it stems from Dr. Dunham's third or fourth slide on the 2007 Commission Communication on Organ Donation, where he states that organ donation has to remain strictly non-commercial. Of course, this begs the question of how organ donation can remain strictly non-commercial when healthcare itself has become so grotesquely commercial. And my question is, how does organ purchasing compare between for-profit medical care and welfare state medical care? In other words, are there welfare states
that
these taxpayers money to buy
organs from
abroad, or is this something that is strictly a function of
healthcare
profit?
Is that to anyone particular or to the panel generally?
Strictly non-commercial, we mean it. Non-commercial, you don't give money to buy the organ. Now, if you need money to pay the expenses of a hospital or a private kidney clinic, this is not the main task of the report. By stressing non-commercial means you don't pay money to buy somebody organs.
Well, let me be a provocateur here and say that in the United States today, there's tons of buying and selling without brokers. And I don't know quite what we do about that, because they're buying and selling online through Craigslist and through something called matchingdonors.com. If you go on Craigslist or matchingdonors.com, and I know the founders of Matching Donors, two very interesting guys from Boston that operated out of a basement. They have very good intentions, but there's no surveillance of what goes on. That is, they state the law of the land, NOTA says, no commerce. So this has to be altruistic. But I interviewed people that are listed publicly. I don't know if they still are. It's very painful. People put themselves on the list and they go, you know, I'm a mother of 42 and I've done all these good things in my life and I was a Girl Scout and, you know, I was a good, important person in my neighborhood, but unfortunately there's nobody around to give me a kidney. I'm looking for an altruistic kidney. And we called these people, a graduate student and myself, and found out that they had to listen to 20 or 30 or 40 telephone calls, which is, give me a break, you know, what, I'll give you one, but what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do for me? So some people just can't do it and won't do it, but others do. And so I was about a month ago in Cedars-Sinai Hospital while a young man and his extended family of one ethnic group handed to a young, newly arrived Korean two brothers, one that was coerced, I believe, by the older brother to be a kidney seller, and $25,000 in cash, $100 bills, went up the elevator in a very, very large backpack. I met the donors. I met the recipients. The nurses knew. The doctors knew exactly what was going on because they kept the recipient, the donor, rather, hidden on a floor, not where the normal recovery was, tucked behind. It was very hard to find him. So what I'm saying is this trafficking or isn't? Is it commerce or not? But this is the form I think it's going to take, because most people in the world who have gone through brokers really hate the brokers. You know, a guy that sold in Mount Sinai in 2006 through brokers in Israel and brokers in Brooklyn was promoting the ability to write, to buy and sell, but said, I don't even want to talk about the brokers, they were horrible. So what do we do when people are just going to figure out that it's easier to just go online and find somebody and make some calls until somebody agrees, whether it's 15,000 or 20,000? I mean, I'm trying to be, I mean, I agree with you, I mean, 100%. I think that you can't, even though commerce is, medicine is commercialized and we have for profit, and the United States is the worst example of it, the whole point of a transplant was based on social solidarity, a kind of reciprocity that is based on, you know, the old Malthusian anthropological notion of the gift. That is gifts circulate. They're returned, but they're returned in kind. They're returned collectively. They're not necessarily returned to you. I may need a transplant. My children may need one, whatever. So that's why I give. Once you put it on the commercial basis, it kind of destroys the whole notion of it. And I think that's why people that are passionate about transplant, as surgeons, as transplant coordinators, as running tissue banks and organs banks, why in Istanbul everyone sort of agreed hands down was the opening gesture of Francis Delmonico was to put one slide, and it was a slide like the slide I opened with of a bunch of guys, you know, with a big scar, and he just turned to the audience of transplant professionals from, you know, 73 countries, and he said, is this why we became transplant surgeons? Is this just? And nobody could answer, you know, negatively to it. It's not why people became transplant surgeons.
The lady in the white jumper, green jumper, and the lady just in front of you with the glasses, have your hand up. I will take those two together.
Sorry. No.
Yeah, there have been allegations about death camps for, you know, political prisoners, but and those, as far as I know, there was a report from Canada, but it didn't have any base. I mean, there really was no data in that report. It was gossip, essentially. So I would say but of course, executed prisoners were used, and some of those people, you know, might have been executed and been part of it. But it's like the Swedish article saying, you know, did the Israeli military kill people for organs? No, they're already dead, you know, and then they used them for organs. And I think the same would be for China. China did have a policy. They finally come clean at one of the international transplant meetings. A group of us sat down with a bunch of Chinese delegation saying, why do you deny it? Look at Iran doesn't deny it. They're not a pariah. They get up and say, look, we have a regulated sale of tissues. It's not destroying us. There's lots of dissent about that within Iran and outside. But I said, they get up and talk about it. Why don't you? And, you know, eventually they did start admitting that the source was coming from executed prisoners was the usual source. But now that's in question.
Could I just offer a supplementary? I know nothing about the death camps point, which is entirely anecdotal and overdramatic, probably. I had quite a lot to do with the Chinese and the drafting of their Organ Transplant Act and went over for the first conference. And it's an interesting point, this. I don't think it's the case that all donation of organs from executed prisoners has stopped. They maintain that they asked them for consent before. And it's, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it, as to what form this consent takes. But they are, they have made some attempt. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, their problem, and I sense a determination on their part to push this through, Their problem is the size of the country. And what they've found is that the regional people who are getting quite a good rake off, it's very pretty, isn't it? The regional people are less inclined to comply. And I heard through my contact in Beijing that this is the big problem that they're finding. I mean, I will just share with you an interesting thing that I never knew until I went to China, and that is that the places where the organ transplants occur are the major hospitals that are run by one-star generals of the People's Liberation Army, and it is they who have strongly resisted any change.
Okay, I'll take a group of three questions and beat the bell. The lady in glasses, you had a question. And then got one here. And
the one in the second row.
Yes, you can see that. And was there one at the back? Did I see a hand? Three? Yeah, and the gentleman in the glasses. So, the lady there. Can I just take a break and then we can do before the at the time. The lady next to you, did you have a question? Can I see your hand go up? No, we'll take a group of questions, so yes. Bringing the lady on the front here.
I understand. I think that's what I'm asking.
Okay. Three very good questions there, Fiona.
I'll kick off then with a demographic question. The answer, the Department of Health, no. But obviously, as you probably know, the NHS Blood and Transplant Authority, NHS Blood and Transplant, collect a wealth of data, a huge amount of data. And if I want data, I go to them. And I suppose what I don't know is to what extent they're analysing their data on people that go abroad and come back. But I was thinking about it while the other questions were asked. I mean, obviously, we've got some work pending. We've got the work coming out of the action plan that Anna is leading with member states, the priority actions for the EU, and it's whether we will need to use the data that we collect in the UK to feed into that, and I suspect we probably will on definitional stuff and things like that. But I would draw on their data. We don't quite know what's going to come out of the UN, I suppose, following the announcement a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, I suspect we're going to feed into that. So although they have the data, at the moment we haven't done a great deal with it. The data is sitting there. It's no doubt incomplete. I'm sure we don't have all the statistics of all the people that have gone abroad and had transplants and come back to the UK. So I suppose at some stage we need to interrogate that and see how complete or incomplete it is and how we want to use it. So at this stage it's a rather incomplete answer, I'm afraid, but it's I think over time we may do some more digging. Well, obviously, a transplant costs a lot less to maintain than keeping somebody on dialysis, but I think it goes... But I stand by what was said on the panel. You know, we do not support commercialisation in the UK.
Something here. You know, there is another directive. We voted this before the end of my mandate in June 2009. It is called cross-border healthcare. You imagine the impact on the what we discussed today? You are asking that I'm receiving a transplant in another country, and I'm coming back to my country, and I demand and I ask, you pay me for everything. What I did in the other country, I mean the European Union. This is a very, very important directive, a very complicated directive, which is complicated the whole thing. Because now with this, as I told them in the parliament, they opened the Pandora box. And this started from one UK lady who had a hip or knee replacement, refused to be on the waiting list for 2 years. She went to France, she had the replacement, and she came back to the National Health System of UK, and they asked him to pay the hospital. They refused the system, the NHS here. And she took them to the court, to the European court, and she won. And from this, we decided that from now on, about health issues, is not the courts that they're going to decide, but it's politics and politicians that they set laws for this. And so we voted for this, which is a very important directive. It's the first time we have a directive on health issues, because till now we consider it subsidiarity issue. So for health issues, it's the member states responsible. But now with this directive, so sometimes maybe we have to see these or this through this directive as well.
Can I just add one thing to this? That is that the Istanbul Declaration also made very, very clear, and I think that it's a very good declaration. I was not really critical of that, although I think it's hard to implement. But they said that any country that wants transplant, A, has to strive to be for autonomy, that is that you take care of it yourself, you don't outsource, that's not fair. And secondly, that any country that wants transplant should have a deceased donor program and not jump that and go just for the living donors. I was at a meeting in France in June, and I was amazed to learn the differences in Europe are extraordinary. The Norwegians have lots of living. The French don't touch it, 5%. And they're pretty autonomous. They really fulfill most of their organ transplant needs with deceased donors. So it really becomes a question of organizational sociology, doesn't it? Why can Spain do it? Why will France say, we're not going to go for living donors? And, you know, so I really do think it is this. Then to answer the question about human dignity, I don't use human dignity. I've never used it. My friend Frank Delmonico does, because I think exactly as you say, human dignity means different things, and the selling a kidney means very, very different things. But justice is another issue. And what's inherently wrong with outsourcing and going for the poor is that you're giving them a proposition that they can't turn down. So, you know, it has nothing to do with human dignity. I think most of the things humans do, you know, is not very dignified, and yet you still embrace them as part of the human, right? I love critical thinking. I've done it myself. I've turned myself inside out about how I feel about these things. It's not against critical thinking. It's that this is where I land. This is what I found of 12 years. People are going to argue. They'll argue, well, you know, so many other parts of the body are commodified. What's special about the kidney? We could have these arguments forever. But where I fall is that human trafficking by organized groups that with a government or a military that approves outsourcing kidneys to another part of the world, I'm sorry. I just think it's a violation of human justice, global justice. That's where I land. But we can argue forever. I love critical argument.
I'm sure we will. And there's time after. I know we're pushing the time so much. But I do just want to make sure this lady's question is addressed quickly about the regulation of the market. Anyone would like to take that up?
Well, no. It's...
Yeah.
But your point was about the HFEA. And no. I was going to say that, and there are colleagues from the Department of Health who know much more about this than I do. But as I understand it, you're referring to the suggestion a few weeks or a few months ago by the chair of the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority that more sperm donors might be encouraged to come forward. If they are offered money, is that's what you're referring to, and egg donation, and I can only remember the sort of sperm thing because there were various reasons for the decline in sperm donation. The authority has not discussed it and hasn't taken a view on it because it's not, as far as I'm aware, official HFEA policy. All I can say to you is personally and privately I've discussed this with the chair of the Human Tissue Authority, and I would put it no differently other than to say that we have some concerns about, on the one hand, doing one thing that on the other the law prevents us from doing in respect of organs. But it's interesting that even in the Human Tissue Act, the only prohibition is on organs in terms of commercial dealing. You could sell your body after you're dead, providing you sign the requisite consent forms and have them witnessed, I suspect, for as much money as you can get for them. And that would not be illegal. Ditto other tissue, but you can't for organs. So there is there isn't consistency in this. All I'm saying is that if that were to come to pass, would that open the door to commercial dealings in organs?
I don't know.
Well, I think it's surprising. I'm nodding because I do agree with you, it's surprising. But I don't think it's policy. So it was a suggestion, and I don't, as far as I'm aware, that suggestion has not taken root.
But
I think that the someone answer, is there is just the going answer. To someone is oh, just well, going oh, to make a comment about that.
Over our slated close. Would you please just join me in thanking our speakers once more for their contribution. Thank you very much. I'm sure, within reason, if you have a pressing question, you can nab them as they head out the door, but I'm sure they've got other things to move on to. Just a few concluding thoughts, concluding points rather. Inside your information packs, you'll find an evaluation form. I know they're the bane of all of us that go to conferences and seminars, but we really would like to hear from you what we do well, and if there are any aspects that you think we could have improved upon, please do communicate that to us through that form. There is a box on the table for you to put those forms in. There's information about our 2010 series of events, which will be coming along shortly. Please do make a note of those, and also stay in touch with us for further information. And finally, thank you very much for attending this afternoon, and a pleasant journey home. Thank you.
Thank you.